the first, within 1 year then, you at least had some support in terms of someone else in history.
Yes.
And was there, as although you did have continuous preparations, was there any growing community among the faculty?
Yes, there was a growing community, which I really would put it this way. I think the community spirit was represented in social gatherings. To illustrate, in the first year, probably about November of 49, roughly there, November, December, President Mr. and Mrs. Peterson had a dinner for the faculty and their spouses at the Masonic Temple downtown Long Beach. I forget, Sun Elm or one of those streets. And I remember President Peterson's remarks that night. We were all seated around one great big table. And his remark was, this is going to be remembered in the future as an historic event where the entire administration, faculty, and spouses could gather together at one table and have it like a family dinner. That type of thing was done, and there was a lot of socializing in the sense of interest groups, bridge groups, women that might be interested in sharing, that is, wives of male faculty members that might want to get together to discuss kind of a literary, I think they call themselves the eggheads, that wanted to have kind of monthly meetings to discuss new books. There was a great deal of support. Let me illustrate. It was either, I guess it was the spring of 1950. My little boy, who was 3 years old, we lived in an apartment near the campus, had gone out to play, and my wife thought he was in the front yard. He was gone. Couldn't find him anywhere. She called me down at the apartment house and said, I can't find Steve anywhere. Mr. Hackney, the business manager, announced it on the patio that my little son was lost. And we combed Park Estates, where there weren't many homes, a lot of empty ground, all over the Pacific Coast Highway, up Anaheim Road, looking for Steve. The student body turned out, you know, this is unique, looking for my little guy. And finally, I don't know how long after, we found out he was a neighbor's house. A little lady had invited him in to teach him how to play cards. He was 3 years old. She was teaching him, he said, she was teaching me fish, Daddy. You know. But this is unique, the caring people really had for each other. And that, I think, is something that we've missed, even though later, within a few years, the faculty was split over the loss of faculty members by their being fired. Yet in those first several years, I think we cared, and to this day, those that are still living, you know, they phone, they call, they visit back and forth, that type of thing.
It sounds like the period 49 to 52 is sort of a period that's somewhat self-contained in a lot of ways.
Probably 49 to 51. Beginning in 52, I think the strains were beginning to be felt in the sense that we were learning many different things about the administration. Not only Peterson, but other administrators, particularly one, who did what the president bid him to do. And we felt, most of us, and I was learning, because I was learning from other faculty members who had been in other institutions with greater experience, that we really weren't being consulted. We felt as if we were there, but we were only figureheads. Many of us felt and started to feel as if we were employees rather than colleagues. And I think that's when things were starting to brew, and especially when we started to learn that there were various techniques of hiring faculty of which we did not approve, and things were leaking out from secretaries of codes that were being used on folders of applicants that might indicate whether they were of one religious faith or another, or whether they were of one ethnic origin or another. It was these things that started to disturb several of us. Yet we had no proof for anything.
And this came mainly through the secretaries?
As far as I know, it started to leak, though there were secretaries, like the president's own secretary was a very loyal person. But some secretaries had found out how, I'd love to know, that applicants' folders could be marked with the Star of David, for example, if the individual was Jewish, or a cross if the person was of the Christian faith. Now, as I say, this is something I cannot prove, and as an historian, I probably shouldn't even speak of these things, but this, I'm speaking about what we heard.
I'm sure we can find one of those secretaries.
Yes, yes, and I can find, you know, say that, yes. And those are things that started to disturb some of us, plus the fact that when we were coming up in 52 for review, for retention and being recommended for tenure, and saw people like Bob Ross and Liz, English, I should remember her name, I'll come to it perhaps later, being told they weren't going to be retained, knowing that they were unusually good teachers, but probably engaging in things in class which Peterson didn't approve of. We felt it was a violation of one's academic freedom. Because there were certain surveys, for example, that Bob Ross was doing among his students in psychology, which probably was considered a little far out for 1950-51. It would be some of the things such as the Kimsey Report and that type of thing, which studies which he'd made back at Yale, which he was continuing here. But it was strange, and I suppose I shouldn't be on tape saying this, but it seemed with President Peterson that you just didn't mention the word sex.
Well, it's interesting because it would happen several years later than with the Ross.
That's right. Exactly.
In fact,
very early. Liz Jacobs was the woman's name in English, and a very, very gifted person. She was the type that would come in, for example, we had a little switchboard, and in her own kidding style, she'd say to me, "Earl, what are you doing this afternoon?" You know, class was ended at noon. I said, "Oh, Liz, back to the books, getting ready for tomorrow." "Oh," she said, "there are more interesting things to do than that. Why don't you come to my apartment?" This was Liz Jacobs. You know, she didn't mean anything by this, but that's the kind of...
She was a single woman?
And she lived in Manhattan Beach, and with some of her classes, she would invite them, you know, to have an evening in her home. And they were all mature students. They were all upper division students. And she served beer. And Peterson was a man of temperance. And he didn't like it. And word even circulated later, oh, these were sex orgies that were going on at Liz Jacobs' apartment. Liz was probably not much older than I was. I would say just a couple years older. She was in her early 30s. I would guess. I could be wrong. She could have been a little bit older because she had had some experience teaching before coming, but then I'd been in the service, so, you know, it could have been very close, but I know she was at least 2 to 3 years older than I was.
Was she the only single female faculty member?
No. In January of, that first year, he also appointed a woman in education. In fact, if you would look at our faculty in that first year, I would say, other than the ethnic groups, he was hiring women. Part-time, for example, we had a part-time woman that I finally was able to get to teach in history in the second semester. And he had a woman, I forget even what her name was now, but she was working on a PhD at USC, and she taught in the field of education. He had Liz Jacobs. Then in January 1950, he brought in Liz Nelson, who just retired last year. She was in English, and she also was Dean of Women.
I raised it in terms of, I wondered what the relationships were among the faculty, how the single, unmarried women faculty fit in, because I've interviewed some women who have taught since UCLA after having taught at Yale College, and she talked about the problem she had as a female faculty member. When there were events that would include the male faculty and their wives, she was sort of always If there was an event for faculty wide, she would be invited to that. If there was an event for faculty, she would not be invited.
No, this is not true at all. No, in fact, I think they were, the faculty wives, for example, almost went out of their way to, at any function that was for faculty, including, you know, spouses, to talk to the, to be with them, to get to know them, to invite them to their homes. I never, never felt that kind of discrimination at all. Now, in the interviewing, one might find, you know, if you talk to Liz Nielsen, I doubt it. She was a great admirer of Dr. Peet. In those early years, she always spoke of Dr. Peet. And she loved him. She really loved that man greatly. And respected him. I never saw, in fact, I guess I may have been just ignorant or blind. Because I had been, as I think I said in our last interview, had been influenced greatly by women faculty members. You see, my college experience, I became a history major because of the one I had in my undergraduate work. And in my graduate work, though I had a fellowship and was not to do anything, I was one who, just to get experience, worked with Louise Burnham Dunbar, who was a specialist in colonial America, and became very close to her in my learning colonial history. And she had me, you know, grade papers. I didn't get any pay for it, but she bought me books and, you know, did things of that nature. And I never felt, was I conscious of the fact that there would ever be discrimination. Mm-hmm. Because I've had as many women faculty members, just about as many women faculty members in my collegiate, undergraduate, and graduate work as I think any person would have ever had. They're almost evenly divided.
Most of the other male faculty members fully accepted.
Yes, very much.
When was there, as there began to be some kinks in the first 2 years?
Yes.
Was there increasing informal networks being developed among the faculty?
Yes. I think we became, I guess it would be about 1952, over the firings, that we definitely came to have lines of demarcation drawn among us. We were all called in and, of course, told certain things, those of us at least that were the original faculty. And I was told that my work was much appreciated, that I had done a good job. Keep it up. But keep your nose clean.
You were called an individualist.
Mm-hmm. And these are the exact words of the president to me. You're doing a fine job. We want to keep you here, but keep your nose clean. Don't get involved with some of these faculty members that look as if they're going to cause trouble. And they were named.
Who did he see those?
And he saw those as Bob Ross, Liz Jacobs. He did not mention his administrative dean, Dr. Brown, which I learned later, was one too. But particularly those people. Stay away from them. You're young. You'll be influenced. Be careful. I see a bright future for you here if you keep your nose clean.
Is that essentially what you think that you told most of the others that you've told them?
I think so. I checked with a couple, and whether the wording was identical, it nevertheless was in that same spirit or that same vein. And their thought was that the faculty has its role, but its role is in the classroom with students. The administration has its role. We make the decisions, and you accept them. And much of our complaint, and which was my complaint later then, I immediately sided with Bob Ross and Liz Jacobs. And had the experience, but by doing so, of having Dr. Peterson call at my home on a Sunday afternoon with his wife and asking me why I was taking the position that I was taking, which was not on his side.
This was after they were already fired?
Yes, they were already told that their contracts would not be renewed and they were not being recommended for tenure. And I said that Dr. Peterson and I can't reproduce exactly what my words were. But I had taught that morning, it was a Sunday, and I had taught an adult class at a church. And I remember we had discussed the thought process and dealing with what sort of things are true, what sort of things are lovely, what sort of things are good to report. Keep your mind on these things. I said, Dr. Peterson, on the basis of what I've been discussing with a group of adults this morning, I can only live with myself if I deal with things that are honest, that are good reports, and that I know, to be honest, I can't deal with schemes, I can't deal with tricks. And he said, well, I think you're being misinformed. And I said, well, Dr. Peterson, if I'm being misinformed, you're the only one that can tell me. Wherein am I being misinformed? He said, I'm unable to tell you. He, as much as said to me, is there any position that you are aspiring for in this institution? And I said, that has never entered my mind. I came here as a faculty member, and I've never aspired to any administrative position, nor have I thought of administration. And the reason, incidentally, he came to me is because there was going to be a court appearance where to which some faculty would be, no doubt, subpoenaed. A hearing conducted basically by the State Board of Education with sponsorship of Roy Simpson, who was then State Superintendent of Public Instruction, because that was our structure at that time.
These people went to appeal to the...
Yes, they were going to appeal. There was going to be a hearing and investigation. And he knew that if I were called, that I would not testify on his behalf, because I felt that if a person's going to be fired, you need to be told why. You need to be able to face the accusations. And I felt, I said, to be fair, I'm a person that's fair. I feel if somebody says something about me, I want to know what's being said so that I can respond, that I could call in witnesses and all the rest. And he said, well, that isn't the way I operate. So as a result of that, I was told, shortly after that, that, well, I was just lucky. I was had already been recommended for tenure. But it was very likely that I would never be given a promotion.
Now, you came in at what level?
Assistant professor, first level.
With the understanding that it was a 2-year contract?
No promises at all. It was just, I came, yes, not knowing if there'd be any second-year contract. There were no promises made. It was just that you are hired for this year as an assistant professor at a salary of $4,200.
And then after the first 2 years?
Then each year you were reviewed, called in by President Peterson, and there was no classroom visitation, but it was a situation that was small enough where all of us knew pretty much what everyone else was doing. You knew who was doing a poor job as a teacher, and you knew who was doing a good job. This was common conversation. It just got around. You know, small town. Mm-hmm. So the president, no doubt, had this information, and probably even had a network by which he even got more information, because we found out later that he actually used students. He had students that were literally, in some cases, some believe, planted in certain professors' classes in order that they could be sort of stooges. Now, I cannot verify that. Probably Dr. Hardy, I'm sure, could verify that in his case. My case, there was nothing. Dr. Peterson never corrected me on anything. The only thing was, he said, don't associate with a certain group, keep your nose clean. But after my taking this stand, and I did receive word that I was possibly going to be subpoenaed to appear before this committee, I guess it wasn't the court, it was a committee of investigation, but I was not. But I felt very uncomfortable, and I immediately reopened my files at the University of Illinois in the Placement Bureau, and I wrote to my mentor, Dr. James G. Randall, and said that I felt that it was time that I moved on, that I found myself in an impossible situation. I didn't know what my future would be academically. Dr. Randall said, well, he says, you're just starting to learn what higher education is all about. And being a man of long years of experience, because he died just a few years later, he was a man then, in his late 60s, he said, you're going to find that there are what we call campus politics. You're not going to find any place free of it. But he said, I do have calls, and I certainly am going to recommend you. So he says, we'll keep your file active. I even went out to UC Irvine, which was going to begin, several of us, in fact, went as a caravan, just to find out what the possibilities were going to be there. Great discouragement in the sense of saying there is no future here. And yet other faculty members saying, and I remember one of them being, and you probably should interview Howard Kimball, who has a long memory, and who fought Dr. Peterson with all that he possessed. And he can tell you some very interesting episodes. And we could document some of us on the other side, although I was basically on his side. But he was the one who, probably more than anyone else, said to me, well, Irv, you don't run away. You know, if we're going to make an institution here, we've got to stay. Or it's going to be taken over, and as Frank Nelson put it, who is now in Hawaii and was in the English Department of Faculty, would be a very interesting person to interview. He comes to the mainland quite often. Frank Nelson said, you know, if we leave, this place will be taken over by the cuckoos. And he related that in an analogy to what he felt had happened at, I think it was the University of Arkansas, where there had been a political battle in the faculty, and he felt the cuckoos eventually went over, and the good ones, the conscientious ones, mm-hmm. left.
What was the division in that first early beginning of the struggle there?
It was almost down the line, almost middle. I think I can say that quite honestly. It was just about down the middle.
What does that mean? How did it translate itself towards the students? The students must have known some of the...
What is so tragic about it, as students were being recruited for both sides. And I don't like to use people. I have a thing I call, you love people, but you use things. And I, in fact, even talked about that last night when I was discussing some of William Faulkner's novels, which he brings out so effectively. You don't use people. And I objected greatly to the idea of using students, putting them in a position where I found that on the side opposite of mine, which was the post-Peterson faction, there were people that were promising students financial aid, certain grades. Again, as I say, this is only hearsay that I have. But I don't doubt it. I tend to believe there was some truth. I did find out later that there were some benefits granted. Now, whether they were financial or whether there was something material that was given, I don't know. But there was this attempt to recruit students. And you found in classes students reacting to you as to which side you were on. It was like suddenly we had a two-party situation. Are you of my party, or are you of the other party? And that led to a bifactionalism, which I felt was very sad on the campus, because students, in some cases, you know, they'd fight. They were older. These weren't youngsters, you see. And being older students could see the dynamics, I think, of the situation. And seeing the dynamics and feeling keenly for some faculty and others feeling keenly for the administration got caught. And those animosities exist to this day in some circles.
Do you think that some students actually left over in terms of there just being too much tension and too much division?
I would have no knowledge of that. I would only answer perhaps this way. I don't think many had the financial capability to go anyplace. Where would they go, you see? Most of them lived within short commuting distance of the institution. And perhaps L.A. State couldn't afford to go to UCLA, and some of it's too far away. USC, impossibility. So it was lack of any choice. Whereas today, with a number of state college universities within a commuting distance, it would have been a different situation. But if they wanted to complete what their objective might be. Now, one student told me that he was literally told that if he did not come on the side of the administration, he would be blackballed. And he would see that, like, wherever he looked for a job, and he was going to be a teacher, he'd see he didn't get a job.
Now, did students come and talk to you about it?
Oh, yeah. Things were very open, very open. Yes. It was amazing at the openness. When you consider the smallness, of course at 52, I don't recall what our enrollment was, I'd have to check. But there was an openness about it, And I don't think people were afraid to talk to each other, though it destroyed personal relationships among some, between faculty. I felt very badly because there were some faculty whose friendships I cherished, but who would not speak to me because I was not taking the position of the administration. Fortunately, in that one case, it was Sam Wiley, and Sam was an older man and afraid of, you know, where would he go? I didn't have the fears. Mm-hmm. I thought I was young. I could move on. I could do something else or other institutions. Sam was frightened. Yeah, he had once studied for the Jesuit priesthood. And years later, Sam told me that he was very sorry that, you know, that had happened, and he asked me for forgiveness. And I delivered a eulogy at his memorial service here. He was then dean of our new School of Humanities, and I was asked to deliver the eulogy, which I was delighted to do. So we had overcome that by that time. But the fractured relationships at the moment, it affected, you see, even the relationship between the wives. And Mary Peterson, whom I loved very much, even, you know, then I loved her, but she didn't understand my position. She would not speak to me. She would not speak to my wife. And it hurt because I remember that first Christmas that we were here. They lived also in the, they had their home in San Jose, and Dr. Peterson had an apartment in Park Estates, and she would come down and visit. She was down here at Christmas, and she came over to the house and sat in the apartment, and there in the living room, took my little boy in her lap and read him stories about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. She was like a grandmother to him. She was close to my mother's age. And to me, that was such a sweet and, you know, moving experience to see her do that. And then within a few years, to see bitterness and dissension and fracturing of relationships. To me, that was the hardest thing I ever went through.
Now, this began in the beginning of 52 or at the end?
Yeah, toward the end of 50. Really, I guess it was about the spring of 52 when we were being called in as to whether or not we would be granted tenure. So it would be the spring, and then, of course, spilling over badly into the fall of the 52 semester. Mm-hmm.
So you weren't, at this point, had you moved into the temporary buildings on campus?
Oh, yes. No, we had moved from the apartments and weren't in the temporary buildings on the lower campus. Yes. And it, you know, I even wonder to this day why I stayed. In fact, Dean Brown said to me, I went home, I think it was the summer of 50... Yeah, the summer of 52, my wife and I and my little son go back to Illinois to see our families. And he thought for sure that I would be phoning him or saying something that I had resigned. He said, Irv, I never thought you'd come back. And now, that could have been the summer of 51. I'm not sure, because I don't think he had been fired by then. So it must have been the summer of 51, because we had started to see like a small cloud on the horizon. Mm-hmm. Some things were brewing, shaping up, that didn't look quite right. Things were also coming along. Now, that could have been a little bit later. My chronology isn't as good here as I'd like, but later, such things as Lloyd Whaley offering lots in Park Estates. He did offer lots to faculty members at a little lower price. I will admit that, but, you know, at $4,200, I couldn't afford a lot at $3,600. But anyway, the word got around later that much of the lumber that was used in even Dr. Peterson's home was donated. And, you know, all these stories, whether they were true, we'll never know. But it spelled one thing, this corruption. What's the nature of it? And when you couldn't get to the bottom of it, it's like a Watergate. It's like a Korea gate. You know, you say, we know there's something wrong, but we can't find out what it is. And I'm sure state money was used for a lot of things that were private. Should never have been used. It was. Even men working in maintenance testified later. They were asked to work in the lawns, or put in the lawns with administrative personnel. These are things that we don't like really to talk about. But, those were the real facts, the hard facts, that some of us were having to look at.
Yeah.
I suppose I stayed, as I say, largely out of the admonition and advice of older faculty, that were, not that they were older in service on this campus, but older in years, that I should stay, and I did. I liked California, and I dreaded the thought of going any other place. I was offered a deanship back in the Middle West of a small liberal arts college, which was very attractive. And yet I thought, and this is really what entered my mind, am I going to run away, or am I going to stay and fight? And I finally came to the conclusion, as I look back, that I was going to take the college way out, and I was going to leave. And I always felt that there was something that could be built here. And years later, if I had left, and I would come back, and I'd say, you're a fool, why did you leave? So I guess I'm a dreamer.
But your dreams were very quickly crushed.
Yeah, very quickly crushed. Yeah, very fast.
Were there, when the lines began to be drawn among the faculty, were there faculty that you had not been close to before who then suddenly became
Yes.
Were there realignments, in other words?
Some realignments, though amazingly, the realignments were very fuzzy to begin with. I wasn't sure. I think many of us that were on the one side that were basically anti-administration were the type that had images of what academic life is about, what the government of the university is about, as we thought, and which I think traditionally and historically is that the faculty govern a university. It is that group that had its greatest affinity. And it's that group that pretty much stayed together. Where the realignment came was with, for example, a friend of mine like Sam Wiley, whom I mentioned, whom I'm sure felt the same way, but out of fear, saying, where would I go from here? Changed his position. Yet there were others that stood. They were older. They stood to lose as well. I didn't think I had that much to lose. It was just, you know, pulling up and the cost of moving. But back in 52, mobility within the profession was there. And there were some good opportunities, which one certainly could have grabbed and grasped. But I liked California, and I liked the students. I have to admit, I had never had students with whom I had such a great relationship as I had here. And that was a big factor that kept me, too. I still get letters from them, you know, Christmas cards and letters and phone calls from those early years. Now, I don't get that same kind of feedback now, not as much. I got some, but we were a close unit in those first years. We felt for each other and we understood each other's problems. And
which probably made the divisiveness even more painful.
Yes, I think so too. I think so. Because it was like a family. Mm-hmm. It was like, I'd be like a divorce. Really, is what I think it was. All that trauma that you'd experience going through a divorce, the emotional tension.
That sounds like a good starting point.
Yeah, good.